listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. This show was born out of a desire to help guide parents and adolescent services industry professionals alike to professional resources as they face critical moments with their children and or clients. This show addresses issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and many of the everyday concerns of parenting. Of all the things that we as parents can teach our children, none are more important than how to love, and not just by telling them, but by modeling it, which is why I'm thrilled to have as our guest today a psychiatrist and writer whose three previous books, Only Spring, Too Soon, Too Old, Too Late, Smart, and Never Stop Dancing, have been published in more than 22 countries. His newest book, How to Love, is a much-needed alternative to the trial-and-error learning most of us go through. So my guest today is Dr. Gordon Livingston. Gordon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan. It's nice to be here.
Well, I got to tell you, I've read about half the book. I am very much enjoying it. But some of the things that I'm seeing right off the bat are the things that we do that make mistakes. You know, I'm seeing that there are a lot of things that we do where we think that we are learning, but for the most part, I think that we're also kind of missing the boat a little bit. So I think that the first thing is that, you know, what is your definition of love?
Well, we love someone when the importance of his or her needs and desires rises to the level of our own. And that, I think, is an important thing to grasp, because a lot of people use that word casually. And I think I've often suggested to people that the operational definition of it is the answer to the question of, would you take a bullet for this person? That's a rather limited number of people, it turns out, and certainly our children are included. But if our spouse or a significant other is not, then we need to think about that.
Uh-huh. Now, what specifically should we be looking for as far as traits?
Well, there are the traits that seem to work for us in high school often involve things like physical attractiveness and athletic ability. They tend not to be terribly important in the long run. And so I think the primary trait that we're looking for in a person that we're contemplating spending our life with is kindness. And most of the other traits that turn out to be valuable in the long haul tend to be derivatives of that one. Things like optimism and courage and tolerance, honesty, those are the things that we're looking for. There are some specific traits that we are looking to avoid, particularly self-absorption, and that's where I think people tend to make their biggest mistakes.
Yeah, and I think going along with self-absorption would be the typical narcissist.
Exactly, the narcissist or people who are sociopathic and who are ready to take advantage of other people, or people who are very shallow and histrionic and tuned into the beating of their own heart, but not our hearts.
Well, now, and I know you mentioned kindness and trustworthiness, and I think trustworthiness becomes something that I think a lot of us may have gone into. We may have gone into our initial relationships really thinking that we can trust. Once a person has been burned, how can they make that shift to trust again?
Well, it's difficult and it takes time. You know, there's an old saying that only bad things happen quickly. And the sudden phone call, the diagnosis at your doctor's office, those are seldom good news. The good things in life, you know, our educations, our child raising, our relationships, all those take time. So I think the answer to the trustworthiness question is that I'm in favor of long engagements and being able to see people in very different situations, observe how they interact with us and other people over time. That's why I'm not very fond of the concept of love at first sight.
Well, and I would agree with that, the part about seeing how they interact with other people, because I think oftentimes, you know, they might be on their best behavior for you, but then when you see the way in which they treat the, you know, the waiter, or they treat the valet, or, you know, or their own mother or something like that, I think that when you see those things, are you saying that that's probably a little better indicator of how you may get treated at some point?
Exactly. I think you can tell a lot about a person from the way they drive, for example. That's a good indicator of the kind of people we are, how we treat other people, in the relative isolation of our automobiles. But there are also, there are all kinds of ways to gain these insights. But you have to be around someone for some significant period of time and watch them under situations in which they're stressed or, irritable and see how they respond if you want to get a good sense of what they're going to be like in 5, 10, or 20 years.
Okay, well, now I think you've got me in trouble, because you may have exposed me, because I know as a driver I'm one of the first ones that gets upset and will say something along the lines of, you know, you're not the only person out there, you know, and I'm saying and realizing that they can't hear it, but I know sometimes my kids will hear it in the car and I'm going, can you believe that person? Do they think they own the road?
Yeah, it's not what you say, it's what you do. And so if you're with someone who drives very aggressively or who doesn't seem to have a high regard for the other people on the road, then that's, you know, that's a signal. But there are lots of other things as well in which we reveal ourselves. But the thing that most people don't realize is that basic personality characteristics such as self-absorption, mm-hmm. On the one hand, or kindness on the other, don't tend to change a lot over time. We change in other ways, but our basic character structures remain pretty much the same from late adolescence until the time we die. So this idea that a lot of people have with, all right, he's drinking a little bit too much now, or I don't like this aspect of her character, but surely with my love and with maturity, that will all change. That leads to a lot of disappointment.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, you still got me thinking about the driving thing. I want to share a characteristic that I do, and then you tell me what that says about me. One of the things that I've learned to do and shared with others is, you're driving down the road, it's, you know, a lot of people doing crazy things on the road, and somebody cuts you off and makes you drive into the, you know, the shoulder or something like that. And a friend of mine noticed that I did this, and I turned and looked at the car and said, I'm sorry. And then I kept driving. And the person said, why would you say that you were sorry? And I said, well, it depends on how you look at it. If you look at things as to where there's one universal intelligence, we're obviously sucking up more than our share in this car, which may have caused them to do something stupid.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to look at it, actually.
So, well, now, I mean, basically with what you're talking about with who to avoid as far as people that are a narcissist, or superficial, self-absorption, sociopaths, I mean, after listening to all the people that we should avoid, doesn't that leave like 17 people to choose from?
Well, it limits the number of choices. And this is, I've gotten some interesting reaction from people, because there's one group of people who are called diagnostically borderlines, people who are very impulsive and quick to anger and who are kind of unpredictable emotionally and so on. And I've actually gotten emails from people who say, well, listen, I'm under treatment for this, and here you're telling people to avoid me. Is that fair? And I think that's a good point. But the fact is that most people who have unsavory characteristics, and particularly those who are willing to take advantage of other people and who think mainly about themselves, are not getting treated. They don't recognize that they have a problem. They think everybody else has a problem. So it becomes our job then to be able to distinguish them, so that we don't put them in a position to break our hearts or take our money or do any of the other things that that they might do. So the first thing it becomes an educational problem, and this is why I think a lot of this ought to be taught in schools, because there are some there's some well-documented, well-validated evidence about how certain people fall into personality types and classifications, and what traits one needs to be alert to. And I think if we taught that in high school, it would be at least as valuable as geometry.
Right. Well, what I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're talking about like core character issues. You know, that if it's a core character issue, that's not something that they're going to be able to get medication for, as opposed to someone who, although they may have a great core, great character, they may be very honest and trustworthy, they happen to be going through depression, or they happen to be going through something that is not necessarily a core issue. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm not talking about mental illness for the most part. I'm not talking about people who are beset by depression or have a bipolar illness or are schizophrenic. I'm talking about people who have these, as you say, character or logic issues. Their personalities. Each of us has our own individual set of characteristics that distinguish us from everyone else, and there are habitual ways of thinking and feeling and interacting with other people. And these, because they're habits, we kind of don't notice them. That's why we're the same people today that we were yesterday, fundamentally. And if those characteristics tend toward the selfish, self-centered side, then you are not a suitable person for a good long-term relationship. And a lot of people overlook that when they're going about the business of choosing a partner, because they tend to get preoccupied with something else, such as how physically attractive they are, or how much fun they are to be with at certain times, or what their social or educational status is, and so that, I think, is productive of a lot of mistakes and a lot of people after 10 or 15 years saying, you're not the person I've married. Well, they are the same person you married. You just didn't see it before.
Right. Which actually goes right into that, the kind of old saying where they say that, that women want a man that they can change. I mean,
Well, I think that has some truth to it. I think women tend to be more optimistic about their ability to change people through their tolerance and affection, and that's why they're surprised later on when that change doesn't come about. The person is still drinking too much, or they're still not listening to them, or they still have some they're motivated primarily by selfishness, and so that's what causes this disillusionment when it's really in many ways too late.
Well, now, what is that person? And I guess I'm thinking about it, going, the person that's probably self-absorbed probably doesn't recognize that they're self-absorbed. But if they can recognize that, who are they best for?
somebody else like them. That's where they can do the least damage. And so the answer to the question of, well, what about all these people with characteristics that are unsuitable? I mean, don't they deserve love too? Well, yeah, they do, but not from me or not right. from you. They can, let them marry each other, but if what we want is true love, that someone who cares about us as much as they care about themselves, then we better be careful early on and choose someone with those characteristics. And of course, it goes without saying that we ought to be trying to develop those positive characteristics in ourselves. I mean, the old saying is first deserve and then desire. That while we're looking for the most suitable person for us, we also need to cultivate those same traits in ourselves, which makes it much more likely that we're going to run into that person.
Well, and actually I had made a note of that particular point. I thought that was a great point that you had in the book, which is first deserve, then desire. Again, I think that makes perfect sense. But then the thought of, again, that person where you're saying like goes after like, or maybe should be with like, isn't that person not going to, in other words, they're not going to look at somebody if, let's say, that they're more selfish or whatever. They're not going to look at somebody else and see them and go, you know, that's the person that I want to be with, because that other person is spending too much time worrying about themselves. So they're going to draw the opposite.
We end up marrying our friends, or from that circle of people who become our friends, there are going to be those who generate that some special feeling that is a bit difficult to define, that separates them from somebody we just want to be friends with. But you can tell a lot about yourself by looking at your circle of friends. You know, what kind of people am I hanging out with? I mean, presumably they share the same interests and similar personality characteristics to our own. And so that's sometimes kind of a revelation when we find, you know, if a lot of our friends are alcoholic, how much time are we spending in bars, for example, just to take a simple case. But I think that and it's one of the things that we need to ask ourselves about anybody that we're really serious about, and that is, how does this person make me feel when I'm around them? Mm-hmm. Because that's a very revealing bit of information.
Well, and when you talk about the concept of you know, we marry our friends or the people that we're around, how is that changing now with internet dating? It appears as now you have millions and millions of people that are meeting someone online, and not really in a position to gain that information that you would get by either having them around your friends, having them around family, or even being able to really interact enough and read the true person that they are.
Yeah, of course, and that's why a lot of people meet each other that way, but you're right. You have to realize that this is somebody I'm just meeting, and so I'm going to have to, spend some time, a lot of time with them, finding out what they're really like. I mean, did they represent themselves fairly? These social networking sites are notorious for exaggerations of various sorts. Before you, decided to be serious about anybody who you'd met that way, you'd really want to spend quite a bit of time with them.
Yeah, I agree completely. Now, how important do you think initial chemistry is?
Well, initial chemistry. I think it's important that we feel attracted to the person in all the ways that we can be, intellectually and sexually and spiritually, emotionally. But the problem comes when we turn our minds off, and when we feel so strongly about this other person. Let's say we feel such a strong physical attraction, which is what happens to us in high school when we're first with close relationships, that we feel these hormonal surges and these physical attractiveness may be so important to us that the tendency often is to turn our minds off, and that's why so few of these early relationships work out in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why in general people shouldn't get married while they're still teenagers, because they're not in a good position to evaluate more lasting and important characteristics in the other person. They may be so carried away with the physical attraction, but chemistry, that's an interesting word, and I agree that there has to be something drawing us at all these different levels. And I think the danger is expecting too little rather than expecting too much. I think that we're trained with this, these cliches like, nobody's perfect, so no relationship can be perfect. I think we often sell ourselves short by believing that and not believing that we're entitled to extremely good relationships. There are other kinds of conventional wisdom, I think, that get in our way too. This idea that good relationships are hard work. I mean, that's something everybody seems to take for granted. It's my impression that it's bad relationships that are hard work. At least they're the ones that I see in therapy. I think good relationships should be relatively easy, as a matter of fact. That's, in a sense, what makes them good relationships, is that both people are giving the other the benefit of the doubt, and they love each other, so they're willing to be tolerant and kind, and so there's not a lot of conflict, and there's not a lot of and so the disagreements are resolved relatively easily. But this the good relationships, I refer to that as the pick and shovel view of human relationships, this idea that we got to be working at it all the time. And I think that just means that, that says more about the kind of relationships that the people who give us that little bit of advice have.
Okay. Now, what about if they don't know the difference? You know, in other words, if you have people now, especially in this day and age, coming from divorced families, so they've seen some pretty ugly stuff. Now, at that point, how are they going to know the difference in regards to how hard should we work at it? At what point is this too much work? And if all they've had patterned for them is something that was pretty ugly, how are they going to learn the difference?
Well, this is the problem, I think, that we have, is that we don't have a lot of good role models. You're right that often our parents have had kind of conflictual relationships. There's a lot of separation and divorce. And I frequently meet people who say, I've never seen a really great marriage. So I think that lowers our expectations. Then we have all the people who give marital advice talking about, well, you've got, it's hard work, you've got to negotiate, you've got to compromise. And so I think what happens then is that we end up settling for less than we really want, or perhaps less than we really deserve. So I think a more optimistic way to look at it is that if we're working hard to become the best people that we can, then we should definitely expect a lot out of whoever it is that we end up marrying. And we shouldn't have to put up with with a lot of open conflict, or we shouldn't have to make excuses for the other person for being selfish or not listening to us or drinking too much or doing all those, any of those other things that indicate that they have real character problems. So I think that it's a question of first raising our expectations, and secondly, learning those things to look for, those characteristics. You know, does this person listen to me? Do they really respond to my needs? Is it easy to respond to their needs? I mean, it's not just a question of sharing the same interests, although that certainly helps if you like the same things and have the same, generally the same values. It's important to, I think, to be optimistic about this and say there definitely is someone out there whom I'm going, who I'm going to love as much when they're 50 as I do now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, going along those lines, that, you know, we as parents, you know, what can we teach our teenage children about love? And knowing that as parents, you know, we recently started losing our intelligence in their eyes, you know. So, you know, with that in mind, I mean, what are some of the things we can teach them? Because, again, as I said in the very beginning, I think it's probably the most important thing that we can teach them is how to love.
Yeah, and I think most of what we teach our children is nonverbal. Most of it is what we teach by example and how we behave. And if we behave in optimistic and tolerant and ethical ways, then our children will absorb those values. So it's not a question of lecturing them, although there's some information that can be provided. And I'm trying to provide a little bit of it in this book, but there are other sources of information about what makes for good relationships and what doesn't, and so that I think as parents, the most important thing for our children is how we behave toward our spouse, for one thing, but also how we behave toward them. I mean, do we treat them in fair and respectful ways? Do we listen to them? Do we, do they feel loved? And so those are the ways that the real teaching takes place. But I'm still in favor of having a course in every high school about called the Pursuit of Happiness, taught by the best instructor in school, who goes into some of these personality characteristics and teaches the kids how to recognize them, and who brings in guest lecturers, people who've been in marriages that have lasted 50 years, and people who have been recently divorced, and people who can talk to them about their own life experiences, and so the kids begin to think about the importance of looking beneath the surface of relationships and being able really to evaluate the people that they're thinking about becoming friends with.
Well, you certainly have my vote. At any point in which you want to make that effort, let me know. I will be there 100% to back you up. I've said similar things before from the standpoint of we seem to spend a lot of time making sure that we teach them how to, you know, to work on a car in auto shop, or how to make a box in wood shop, or how to, you know, throw a pot in the pottery class, or even how to learn algebra, which I don't know how often we're going to use. But to then, you know, not have a class that's going to teach them what is going to be in store for them when they get into a loving relationship, into a marriage, I just don't get it.
Yeah, I think schools have been sensitized to this this whole idea that anything that has anything to do with values is going to be taught at home. Unfortunately, I don't think there's enough of that teaching going on. It's hard to teach what you don't know, and so that things like character traits and personality structure and so on are not subjects often that get much attention at home. And if schools are afraid of them for fear that they're going to be criticized for impinging on parental prerogatives, you know, by getting into, because this is value laden stuff. This idea of what constitutes a good person and what constitutes ethical behavior and the importance of placing another's interests at the level of your own. I mean, these are values, and so. I understand why schools are reluctant to get into it, although a teacher up in Montana, interestingly, has put together a curriculum for this class and has sent me, based on one of my earlier books, and has sent me a copy of it, and it's wonderful. It has students writing essays and thinking about traits in themselves and others and what makes for a good relationship. And it's a wonderful, wonderful course. And she's going to teach it this year for the first time. So I'm going to be interested to see how that turns out.
Wow. In fact, I'd love to have a copy of that as well. That sounds great. As we're continuing with as far as teens and such, let me ask a couple of the teen questions that came in.
Sure.
One of which says, what advice would you give teenagers who are new to this attraction to others? It says love or lust. How do we know?
The first, it's not unusual to have a surge of physical attraction to somebody when you're a teenager, but at some point, I think you need to begin to ask yourself exactly this question. Do I really love this person? I mean, is this person's, how do I feel when I'm around this person? Is this someone that I just want to, listen to, and want to be heard by? Is this someone that fits that definition? Are their needs and interests equal to my own? So that takes a little time. Initially, the first hormonal surge is definitely in the direction of lust. it'll become apparent after a while.
Well, and we have another question that says I'm a 16-year-old with one of my I'm a 16-year-old, and one of my friends has a girlfriend who goes everywhere with him, even things that used to be just the guys. He says he loves her, but during those moments when she is not around, complains she won't leave him alone. what can I do as his friend, and without without getting too involved?
Yeah. I think that this is a time of kind of experimentation and trial and error learning. And so I don't think we have to concern ourselves with with what our friends are doing necessarily. You don't have to feel as though we've got to give a lot of advice the best approach is usually to just ask the other person questions. What does this girl mean to you? What do you think about her as a long-term candidate? And that's sometimes a lot easier than feeling as though you have to give someone advice about what to do.
Yeah, and actually, and it kind of makes me think of, thinking back, and they may also be kind of looking at that situation of, where the person really doesn't hang around with you anymore or do the same thing. So I think that, you also have that feeling of they don't want to hang around with us anymore, or when they do, it's only her. So I think there's also that level of camaraderie that one party is losing.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
And let me see. Let's see. We had one. Okay. We have a call that, an email that came in that says, how can you tell if a partner will be faithful in marriage? It says, how do I know if my distrust is because I was cheated on before or the new person in my life is not trustworthy?
Well, it's always something of a leap of faith, but the answer to this question of fidelity, and it's a good question because we're sort of surrounded now in our national life by so many examples of people who turned out not to be what they pretended to be. But here's the basis of fidelity. It's a belief that this other person would not intentionally hurt you any more than you would do that to yourself. And so that's, I mean, that's the real basis of it. It's not a question of denying yourself, on behalf of a relationship. It's the idea that you would not hurt your partner, because their interests and needs are at the same level as your own. So there's no denial involved. It's not a question of having to, and I think that's where people make this mistake. I mean, they see this, this is the last person I'm ever going to sleep with. How can that be? You have to believe that an essential component of love is that the other person, gives up on the idea of being with other people, not because not because they're forced to, but because you're the most important person in their life, and they wouldn't do anything to jeopardize the relationship. Now, from the point of view of someone who's been cheated on before, you have to believe that you know this person that you're going to marry or attach yourself to or commit yourself to permanently, they're being with someone else would be unthinkable. And if you're wrong about that, and people, of course, I mean, we're all human, we're subject to making mistakes and in judgment, then you'll be hurt. But to look for some guarantee, to think that there is something that you can do to guarantee that someone else will be faithful to you is illusory. There is no guarantee of that sort, but you have to believe, at some point you have to believe that you've learned enough about this other person, that you know that they wouldn't do that. So there's some risk involved, but I think you have to be as optimistic as possible, and you can't go through life not trusting people.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I was going to say that's kind of what I hear you saying is that you can't be paralyzed by what other people have done in the past to you, and you have to now focus on the new person and hope that you're not letting those whatever they are, those negative things sitting back in the back bleed through into the next relationship. So
and as with most things in life, our control is very limited. I mean, we don't control the behavior of another person. We can love them, but if it turns out that they're unfaithful to us, that simply means that they didn't love us in the same way.
Right. We have another listener email that came in. It says, my husband and I have been married for 5 years. Like a lot of other people, we have been experiencing some financial problems, and as a result, we've been arguing more and more. We have a young child, and seem to have little quality time at this point. How can we balance our stress with a successful family life?
Yeah, well, it's been a puzzled by this idea that if people are stressed, particularly over something like finances, that somehow that should increase their argument. I mean, what is there to argue about? It seems to me that adversity strengthens a good relationship. It weakens a bad one for sure. But if people have the same objective, if people truly love each other, in the sense that I've described it, then I don't see why they would argue more because the family is under stress. I can see there might be some disagreements about, you know, what to cut back on or how to bring more money into the family, but it seems to me that those would be resolved on some sort of amicable basis because both people want the same thing. So I think a lot of argument in relationships, a lot of criticism. I'm constantly wondering why people feel the need to criticize each other. Is a danger signal. I mean, and that's a danger signal early in a relationship. And it's a dangerous signal if you've been married for 5 years. I mean, some people feel as though they have to criticize the other person in order to defend themselves, but it's not a good sign. I mean, you just have to believe that there are relationships that don't contain a lot of fighting and that don't contain a lot of criticism and work as hard as you can to get into one of those relationships. And the secret to a happy marriage, which is what people are always seem to be looking for, the secret to a happy marriage is picking the right person in the first place. It's not some trick. It's not some negotiation skill, or it's not some ability to compromise. It's picking a person who is not going to fight with you, who is not going to criticize you, who's not going to argue, and who's not going to betray you. And that's why this book is not a book of marital advice. I mean, there's plenty of those. If you want to know what to do if your relationship is faltering, this is not the book for it. The book is focused on the issue of how to choose the right person to start with.
Okay. And let me make sure that I get all these in. So I've got one more here. It says, I am guilty of holding back my feelings as a form of protection. I now know it has hurt her. How can we apologize when we've hurt those we love? How can we make up for our mistakes?
An apology is a good place to start. And the way you apologize to another person is you say, I'm sorry. And followed by whatever it is that you're sorry for. If you've been too withholding in a relationship, then you can talk about how you can be more honest about your feelings. Whatever you've done that has not been good for the relationship, you can apologize for and try to do it better. I mean, this is the nature of an apology. And so you don't apologize to someone, apologize simply because of the fact that they're hurt. You apologize because you feel as though you've done something wrong and are now going to do something differently. So that's what that's what a true apology is. It's a statement of being sorry, but it's also a statement of what you're going to do to, change or to improve the situation. But I think it's a great question because a lot of people will say of their partner, you know, I don't think they've ever apologized for anything. I mean, you know, we have these blow ups and then things get resolved and things are all right for a while and then we have another blow up and nobody ever says they're sorry and nobody ever really looks at what it means that they're having these fights. And so, when I hear people say to me, you know, shortly before we got married, I really had second thoughts about this. I was not sure that this was the right person. But everybody told me, well, it's just cold feet. You know, everybody gets cold feet, and the invitations had been sent and the flowers had been ordered, and so we just went ahead with it. But it's not a good sign. I mean, at the point that you're close to marrying someone, that's the point at which you should be feeling the best about them. And there shouldn't be a lot of mixed feelings or ambivalence there shouldn't be cold feet. You should go into this with the sense that this is definitely, as far as you can tell at the moment, the person that you want to spend the rest of your life with, and what you love about them is the wonderful way they make you feel about yourself.
Again, we're almost out of time. If you can tell us a little bit on how, if anybody has additional questions, how they can get a hold of you or your website, and if they're interested in the book, how can they get that?
Okay, you can get the book anywhere, Amazon okay. or any of the yeah. Bookstores. My website is Gordon Livingston, just all one word, GordonLivingston.com. And there's a contact button there, and I'm happy to hear from people. I'm happy to hear from readers, and so I'll get any emails sent to me through that website.
Okay. So again, that is, the book is called How to Love. I know that I have enjoyed it. I know that it goes over a lot of things. It touches on the people you should cherish. It touches on some of the people that you might want to avoid, or some of the traits. Let me rephrase that. Some of the traits of people that you might want to avoid. Gordon, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Everybody out there, I appreciate you listening. If you have any questions for Gordon, you can go to his website, or you can go to ours at answers4thefamily.com, and we will forward to them. And we will forward it directly to Dr. Livingston. Thank you so much.
Good. Thanks a lot, Alan.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.